the Young and Healthy podcast. You're listening to the Cincinnati Children's Young and Healthy podcast.
Hello, and welcome back to the Young and Healthy podcast. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Kate Setter, your host and MC for today, and I am joined in the studio by Dr. Don Gilbert. Dr. Gilbert, thank you for being here with us.
Glad to be here.
So Dr. Gilbert is a pediatric neurologist, and he's joining us today to talk about tics and tic disorders. So not as in like little creepy crawly tics, but as in movement tics. And before we get into some questions that we've prepared for you, Dr. Gilbert, would you just tell us a little bit about yourself, about your practice, and what you do here at Cincinnati Children's?
Sure. I came to Cincinnati Children's in 1998 because I was very excited to be part of this institution. I started a movement disorder program. That's a subspecialty within pediatrics or adult neurology. And one of the most common types of kids that we see are kids with tic disorders or Tourette syndrome, or sometimes just transient tics. The unifying theme for our clinic is problems with motor control. So having movements that you don't want, too many movements, or difficulty starting a movement or coordinating a movement that you should be able to do. We see kids from the first year of life up into the late teenage years, and we even follow some of our patients into adulthood.
So let's start with, how common are tics in children?
Tics are very common. And there's a couple ways to look at that. Some studies to try to figure that out have put trained observers in classrooms. And if you put an observer in a classroom, you'll see lots of kids with tics who never see the doctor about it because it's very mild and it doesn't cause any interference or impairment, and it's not recognized by anybody as being a problem. So if you do estimates like that in a regular classroom, probably somewhere between 5 and 10% of elementary age kids might have a tic at some point. If you go to a classroom of children that have learning disabilities or a special education setting, that's 3 or 4 times as high, so maybe in the neighborhood of 20%. But estimates can vary a lot. Our clinic's pretty busy, though.
It sounds like. And so I think you gave us a little introduction to what are tics, but what is kind of the definition of what you're looking for, what those observers are looking for when they're visiting those classrooms?
Sure. So a tic is like a habit. It's a patterned movement or sound that looks the same or sounds the same each time it's performed. So if you clear your throat because you have mucus in the back of your throat, it might be a short clear or a long clear, depending on what you're clearing out of there. But if you have throat clearing as a tic, which is quite common, then it would be a very particular sound that the parents recognize. Oh, there's that sound again that he's doing. And it's just it's sort of emitted in a very patterned way.
Is there anything in particular about tics that you think is important to understand right away as kind of foundational to this conversation we're having?
Yeah, I would say a couple of things. This is a childhood onset symptom, so we wouldn't expect it outside of a typical age range. Usually starts between the ages of 3 and 10. So if it starts before that or after that, a doctor or a neurologist needs to be thinking about other possible causes. The other thing is that tics are considered sometimes to be the tip of an iceberg, meaning that the tic is what you see or hear, but beneath the surface, there can be a lot of other things that are a little bit different about the brain of the child who has those. And the doctor that or parent that sees a child with tics should be aware of those other things because those other things might cause problems as well.
Many people associate Tourette syndrome with tics. What characterizes Tourette, and how often is it a cause of kind of that what's under the surface for children?
Well, Tourette syndrome is named after a neurologist from the 19th century who described this, and then it was subsequently followed for many years and initially mainly identified in patients with severe symptoms. Now we realize that it's actually fairly common. We diagnose it in children that have had childhood onset of movement or motor and sound or vocal tics lasting for more than a year. Anybody who meets those criteria meets criteria for the diagnosis of Tourette syndrome. That can still be fairly mild. But lots of kids come in with tics that just come and go for brief periods of time in childhood. That's not Tourette syndrome. That's just transient tic disorder, which is not given that same diagnostic label.
And what advice can we give parents to help them differentiate between kind of those transient childhood tics and a tic disorder that might need additional investigation?
That's a good question. I think parents generally have a lot of common sense, but they also worry mm-hmm. about their children, and it's hard to see your child doing something over and over. Most of the time, if it is a very patterned, repetitive, individual movement or sound that you can count, it's not going to turn out to be anything bad. But if it's frequent and uncomfortable, and if there are other learning or behavioral problems, that's a child who should be evaluated. But not everything that looks like a tic really is a tic. So if a parent's alarm bell is going off, I think there's something wrong with my kid that might not just be a benign tic, they should see a doctor about it and get that evaluated.
And we always ask this question when we're talking about kind of that first step. Is the pediatrician, the child's regular pediatrician who knows them best, the first step with saying, hey, I think there's something going on here and they can do a referral? Or is there a different way that families should go about getting to the care of a neurologist?
That's my preference exactly, to have them see their primary physician first. If the pediatrician or somebody in the practice has concerns about it maybe being something that's impairing for the child, then we're happy to see them as a referral.
Perfect. Are there any misconceptions about tic disorders that would be good for us to be able to dispel right now?
The most important misconception about Tourette's syndrome is that everybody who has it will have a severe form of it with a particular kind of tic called coprolalia, which means swearing tics. So a common image maybe in a comedy movie or in the general perception of Tourette's syndrome, or if you look it up on TikTok or YouTube or other venues, is that Tourette's syndrome is a condition characterized by uncontrolled swearing. And while unfortunately that can occur, that's not a very common type of tic. Another misconception that parents have because they observe their child having difficulty controlling tics is that all the rest of the behaviors they may have as normal children are also uncontrollable. And so one of the things that we can sort of help parents sort out is what to expect their child to try to control and what things the parents can work on just as they would with any other child in terms of controlling behavior.
Are there any other conditions that, are more than just transient tics, as you mentioned to us, that fall outside of a Tourette syndrome diagnosis?
Occasionally we'll see somebody that has one motor tic or one vocal tic for years. Maybe you know somebody that has just had an exaggerated blink for years or a habit of clearing their throat for years. Those kinds of isolated things we might term chronic motor tic disorder or chronic vocal tic disorder, but not give it the label Tourette syndrome because it doesn't involve a large repertoire of different tics over time.
As we were preparing and actually had the opportunity to hear from a couple of parents whose kiddos have tics, there was mention of medication involvement and that medications can sometimes play a role. What is that kind of overlapping and what is that role that it could potentially play?
Sure. Tic disorders or Tourette syndrome are conditions where you have a symptom that's bothersome. It can cause pain, it can cause injury, it can cause interference, or it might not cause any difficulties at all. Similarly, the commonly associated problems of ADHD and anxiety could be on a milder end without impairment or at a severe end with a lot of impairment. So what we do is we see the child, determine which of any of those things might accompany the tics, rank those with the parents and the child. What bothers you the most? What comes in second? What comes in third? Etc. And then decide for each of those one at a time, is there a behavioral psychological type of intervention or a medication intervention? The practice guidelines for Tourette syndrome recommend trying a behavioral intervention first if somebody's having troublesome tics. Mm-hmm. And we have practitioners at Children's who are experts that we can refer to as kind of tic coaches to suppress tics. But if that's not feasible for some reason or the symptoms are quite severe right now, there are FDA-approved medications and other medications which we know can be helpful.
Is there ever a situation where a medication could be causing the tic?
That's a good question and is actually a common reason for referral. People start medications in childhood for one reason or another, And tics can start in childhood for one reason or another. And sometimes those happen at about the same time. Mm-hmm. And it's natural to assume that one thing caused the other. Most of the time when parents are concerned that a medication caused tics, it's a coincidence and it really didn't.
Okay.
But there are some cases where certain behavioral medications or stimulant medications in susceptible people can induce tics or worsen tics that are already present. And so that's a common thing we need to try to sort out.
So you've mentioned to us several different types of tics to this point. Will you tell us a bit more about what the types are and how they, you know, might first show up in the different categories?
Sure, sure. The general rule, which applies most of the time, is that tics will start in the face. So a movement tic would be blinking or stretching your mouth or scrunching your nose in a certain way, and a sound tic would be something very simple, like clearing your throat, sniffing, or humming. Over time, if tics persist, as in Tourette's syndrome, they tend to become more complex. In other words, more muscles might get involved, and they move south. So instead of just being in the face, you might also have tics that involve the body or your limbs. That's a typical progression that we see. And usually tics start between the ages of 3 and 8, mm-hmm. and then they tend to escalate between the ages of 9 and 14, when most children have their most frequent tics. Socially, that's not a very good time to have frequent tics because of issues of stigma or teasing. And so that can cause some problems for kids in the classroom.
And I'd love to kind of expand on that a little bit. What do you recommend if a family starts to see these movements or thinks that there might be tics going on? Like, how should they react? How should they respond? What do they say to the kid?
Yeah, a lot of parents want to know that. And for some reason, the message that they often get is that they should always ignore it and not address it at all. That's reasonable, but you don't want to make it the elephant in the room either, where it's never addressed and everybody's tiptoeing around it. I think what works better for parents is just to say, hey, I noticed that you're having this thing that you do over and over, like clearing your throat or blinking your eyes. Is there anything in that part of your body that's making that happen or bothering you, or does it seem to just be happening on its own? And then parents will often ask if the teacher has noticed it or any other kids, and I ask the same thing. Any kids your age ask you about that? Any of the kids at recess noticing that you're doing that? What do you say if they ask you? And it's important for kids to have a response and for it to be honest and helpful. So some kids don't know what to say, mm-hmm. or they deny it. I didn't do that. That's not helpful. What I try to get kids to do is just to be open and honest with their friends. Yeah, I just have a few tics. That sound is one of my tics. Maybe crack a joke. I have tics, but I don't have fleas. Having a bad tic day. It's ticking me off. Hope it's not ticking you off as well. And then I think everybody can kind of acknowledge it and they're more likely to move on. Similarly, I think by fourth grade, it's really good if a kid can be the one to tell the teacher, hey, I've got a mild case of Tourette syndrome. I've got some tics that I do. Right now I do this. If they can take some ownership in that way, the teachers are on their side.
So when you were just saying that a kiddo could say this particular thing to a teacher to let their teacher know what's going on, you said right now, I might do these things, or this is what my tics look like right now. Will you tell us a bit more about kind of that progression and how tics change over time? I know you said they can get more complex, but can they change from verbal to movement to other types of things?
Yeah, that's one of the really curious and poorly understood things about Tourette syndrome, is why this is a condition that evolves or changes so much over time. So if a child is acknowledging to a grown-up that they have Tourette syndrome, they may have a certain group of tics that they're doing, and they can clarify that's what it is. If it's throat clearing, I have a throat clearing tic. I'm not sick. Mm-hmm. That's one of my tics. But 2 or 3 months later, that tic might have gone away and been replaced by something else. And so when they have new tics, that's another good time to have a conversation with the other kids or with their parents or their soccer coach or whomever and say, this is one of my new tics, so that everyone knows and they can just let it go.
I'm curious about stress and anxiety. And so what you've just described to us sounds like fantastic mechanisms by which to just make it as normal as possible. But are there kids who feel stress and anxiety around their tic disorder? And does it make the tics any worse?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, for example, that fourth grade rule that I gave is partly related to maturity, but that differs for different kids. A lot of kids are very anxious and self-conscious about their tics, and they're also maybe suffering from anxiety in general or obsessive compulsive disorder in general. And having any of those can make it harder to accept oneself and one's own symptoms and interact with other kids. And then it can kind of snowball. So the more nervous they are, the more ticky they get, the more nervous they get, and it just really, really can escalate in that fashion. So I think that teachers and parents should be aware that a child with tics may have anxiety, and that if they do, periods in which they're more anxious may make them tic more. On the good side, the sports that they do or music that they do can actually help shut the tics out. And so even though I might be anxious doing a musical performance in front of other people or playing basketball in front of other people, if I can really get my mind into that playing or that game, actually the tics tend not to occur during those moments. So they have a lot of positive benefit from the activity itself, and they have fewer tics. So it's a win-win.
So I love this that you just shared, that when kids are actively involved, that sometimes it can shut off their ticking. What advice would you have for parents who are like, ooh, I just don't know if they're ready for this because of whatever might be going on with their family?
Yeah, I mean, I think I can validate that. It's just really hard to imagine your kid being in front of other kids and other parents having a lot of tics and feeling like they're going to be the focus of maybe even ridicule. But it turns out that participating in sports and music tends to, at least briefly, shut tics out. So when kids are in the middle of dribbling a basketball or taking a shot, a tic does not interrupt that. And the skills that they gain in controlling their brain and body together through sports or music tends to help them gain better control over ticking at other times. So even though parents might feel nervous about their child being in public having tics, it's really good to get them out there and get them in the game with the other kids.
And if they're nervous, just go for it.
I
love that. We've talked about a few other conditions that can occur alongside Tourette syndrome, perhaps the anxiety. You had mentioned OCD. Is there anything else that we should be aware of that are, you know, co-occurring that could be also at play?
Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is also very commonly associated with Tourette syndrome or a tendency to tic. Also, we see a lot of kids that have had a question raised of autism. They may either have autism spectrum disorder, in which case this is one more repetitive behavior they have, or they may have a few traits and not meet criteria for that disorder. Mm-hmm. And that's common enough that I think doctors seeing kids with tics should be aware that there may be some of the same social challenges that kids with autism have in a person who has Tourette syndrome in some cases.
If parents or caregivers start to witness their child having a tic for the first time or it's brand new, what should they be looking for that might be that kind of indication of, ooh, I want to have a conversation with a medical professional about this?
Well, I think first the parent should just ask the child if they're aware that they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And do they feel that they're doing it or that it's just happening completely involuntarily? The next thing to ask is, are you having any pain in that area where the tic is coming from? Most of the time, the area where the tic is coming from is normal, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes there's a tic happening in a certain body area because that body area has a problem. So if it's really frequent and bothersome, that's definitely a good time to take it to your primary physician to get an initial evaluation and see if something is going on that might be causing that. And again, occasionally it's not a tic. Occasionally it's some other neurologic symptom that may need a different kind of evaluation.
And what could an evaluation look like? What would happen next?
If we see a patient, examine them, take a history, and determine that this patient has a tic disorder or Tourette syndrome. We're almost always right on this one. Mm-hmm. And there are no blood tests, brain MRIs, EEGs, or other tests that are needed to confirm that diagnosis. But there are cases that are atypical or that we really think may be another neurologic condition, such as myoclonus, where you have jerking that could be a part of a neurologic condition like epilepsy. Or there may be other accompanying features that make us more concerned about this child. So there are situations where some of those tests absolutely are important to get. And it's a little hard to give you a rule of thumb that a parent would know to know when that might be more likely.
But at that point, there's medical professionals helping.
That's why we're here.
That's why you're here. I love it. That's perfect. And we talked a little bit about treatment or management earlier. You had mentioned that there are some medications. Will you just walk us through what treatment and management look like?
Sure. So if we decide that the patient is interested in a behavioral treatment, we would refer to people with that training for that therapy, which has a specific name, CBIT, or CBIT, which stands for Comprehensive Behavioral Intervention for Tics, similar to cognitive behavioral therapy for OCD. If they would like medication, if we agree as a collaborating group, the parents, the kid, and me, that medication makes sense, we have tiers of medications that we go through. So I refer to tier one as medications that are highly unlikely to produce a side effect for that child. Tier two is a little bit more likely, and tier three is the most likely to cause a side effect, although it also might be the most likely to help. Because this is chronic, and it's not generally disabling, we don't want to use something that might cause more harm than the condition itself is causing. So we work together and gradually go from the milder tier one medications to the stronger tier three medications if it's needed. I'm really proud to be at Cincinnati Children's, where we do a lot of clinical trials as well. So I've been involved over the years with a number of studies to try to find new and better treatments for tics, either behavioral treatments or medication treatments. And so sometimes that's actually a good option as well.
While the team is figuring out what's next after a tic disorder has been identified, what do you recommend families share with extended family members, other caregivers? We talked about teachers a little bit, but for younger kids, I feel like that's kind of a space where it's hard to know what to say sometimes.
Chances are, if the parents are noticing a certain group of tics at home, other adults are noticing them. Younger children may not be noticing them, but other adults may, and that may result in the child being treated differently than other kids or being punished even sometimes because they're doing their tics. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important for parents to discuss with, not be embarrassed, but discuss with all their coaches, music teachers, school teachers, grandma, you know, extended relatives, if they're spending time with their child, hey, my child has a tic disorder, or hey, my child has Tourette syndrome. Right now, here are the tics that he or she is doing. Please just ignore them. Feel free to let me know if you think they're hurting him, or if they're interfering with schoolwork or other important things, but otherwise, you can feel free just to ignore those.
Have you had experiences where people kind of jump to worst case scenario and think that this is going to just be uncontrollable? We don't know what to do for years on end.
Absolutely. I think it's like a lot of things. We're so fortunate to live in an era of information. But the other side of that is that sometimes the information that we get is unrealistic or creates an excessive feeling of risk. Mm-hmm. There are absolutely patients that have terrible neurologic conditions of every type, but each new child that comes in is unlikely to be at the severest end. And so parents may come in and they're thinking about somebody they saw in a movie or on YouTube or TikTok or whatever, and they're seeing their own child progressing to that stage. And what we say is, I don't have a crystal ball. Based on what I'm seeing, here's how likely I think that is or is not to happen. But if these symptoms are worsening to the point where they are as bad as you fear, again, that's what I do. That's what I'm here for and will help.
We have made it through my entire list of questions. Is there anything that I missed that you think is important that we take a couple minutes to talk about before we finish up for today?
One thing that parents are often happy to find out is that Tourette's syndrome is primarily a childhood problem. So you can have very frequent tics at various points in childhood, but the likelihood that you would have very frequent tics as an adult is fairly low. And so most of the patients that we see, even if we see them pretty frequently in childhood, we're not going to need to see very frequently or at all in adulthood, because as the brain matures, in about 90% of cases, tic symptoms diminish in severity. That's something that parents often find reassuring. And if their child is in that 10%, we actually follow a lot of those patients into early adulthood and help manage their symptoms until a point where it makes sense to transition them to another doctor.
That's fantastic news. I'm so glad that you added that before we wrapped up. Unless you have anything else that you'd like to ensure we get in?
I really have enjoyed working with families of kids with Tourette syndrome. I think the symptoms can sometimes be frightening for parents, but these are great kids, and it's a privilege for me to work with them, and I hope to continue seeing a lot of them as long as I work here.
Well, it's been a privilege for us to spend this time with you today. Thank you very much for your time and for your expertise.
Thank you.
Absolutely. You've been listening to the Young and Healthy Podcast. We'll see you next time. This episode of Young and Healthy was recorded on April 8th, 2024. The content of the Young and Healthy Podcast is for informational and educational purposes only. This episode was produced by Kayla McNeil, and our theme music was created by Stephen Greco.
Thanks for listening. Follow Cincinnati Children's on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.